here. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Lauren Aline is here. She was born in the Twin Island nation of Trinidad and Tobago. She's an associate professor at James Madison University. She's a poet, she's a teacher, and here's Lauren to say hello with a poem.
Hi, Grace. Thank you. This is from my book, Difficult Fruit. Grief etches its silver into our days, singing. What do the living owe the dead? What tribute? What memory? What kingdom? What time? What flesh? What fiction? What will? What mourning? What missiles? What flag? What dust? What patriotism? What purging? What tears? What wick and wax and wavering light? What vigils? What sirens? What capital? What codes? What questions? What mercy? What protest? What burning? What God? What terror? What blood? What wrath? What drafts? What suicide? What occupation? What pipelines? What desert? What hate? What brotherhood? What target? What bomb? What dignity? What sacrifices to their lingering ghosts? What stakes to scorch the guilty? What guilt? What pleading? What prisoners? What speeches? What revolution? What marches? What jury? What freedom? What is left for us to give them? What constitution? What tower do you wait in, O nation of martyrs? What anthem to salute you? What convoy? What genocide? What soldier? What search? What hidden silver? What hostage? What amber alert? What bare feet? What debt? What deliverance? What promises to be kept and which to be broken? What purpose? What redemption? What history? What ritual? What bridges? What answer? What love? What love? What living do we owe our dead?
That is The Power and the Purpose of Lauren Aline. We're at the Library of Congress. You know, death and destruction, they're not easy topics, but you can take them and turn them into something else. And how does that help our culture?
Well, I think that for me, it's really important to interrogate things. I wrote this poem 10 years after 9/11. I had just left New York for graduate school when it happened, and I wrote many bad poems trying to say things. And I think the declarative is tempting, but it's less interesting than interrogative. We ask questions of things. And so I thought 10 years later, I don't have answers, I have questions.
And so the power is in the repetition and the motion and the movement and the momentum, right?
Yeah, and in the asking, right? There's so many things that seem solid and immovable, but questions give them space. And I think that's really critical for us to do in our culture.
Lauren Aline. She's the author of two collections of poetry, Difficult Fruit and Honeyfish. Now, her work has been presented in many publications, the New York Times, The Atlantic among them, the Crab Orchard Review, many, many prestigious literary reviews. But the important thing I'd like to mention is your new award from NAACP. Tell us what that means to be cited as one of, I think, five people for the Image Award.
Yes,
your image. What is your image?
It was just such a beautiful surprise and delight and just an honor. Super humbling.
Did you know anything about it?
I found out a text message from a friend who was also Damaris Hill, who was also nominated. I thought she was pulling my leg. You know, I had no idea.
And what does it really mean? I mean, it tells the world that you're among the brightest and best. And then what happens?
Well, the five of us, and I'm very fortunate to know the five poets who were nominated, so we're going to have a blast. And it's everybody wins because we love each other and we're all friends. And, you know, we go and they find out. But I think what's really important for me about that is to know that somebody read this book, and not just somebody, but that as a Black woman who's an immigrant, you know, always trying to find her place in this country, that voice resonated, and I'm just really humbled and
honored.
And
I'm so proud, too. Lauren Aline, we're so happy to have her. Give us a poem.
Absolutely.
What book is this from?
This is also from Difficult Fruit, and it is The Hoodie Stands Witness for Trayvon Martin. I was built for bodies like his, between boy and man, sauntering in angles he couldn't hold, but swung his limbs from, careful, cool in every step. I can tell you the story of him, unexceptional. He put change and candy into my pockets, the necessary jangle of keys and cell phone hushed in the sock of me. I watched him from the soft pile he made of me on the floor of his messy adolescent room where I lay beside his sneakers and backpack. He did his homework with chat windows open. White headphones hooked him into some steady beat. That day, he was thinking of nothing in particular. He was quiet in his skin, tucked into the shade of me. He was an easy embrace until an old ancestral fear lay its white shadow across us like an omen. I can tell you, his many hairs raised in warning beneath me, his armpits funked me up with terror, his saunter slipped into a child's unsteady totter under the weight of a history staggering behind him, mad with its own power. He clung to me then, wholly unmanned, a baby clutching his blankie. He pulled me close, and I stroked his head, caressed the naps he had brushed to waves that morning. I felt him brace his bones beneath me, his heart a thousand beating drums. The bullet ripped through us like a bolt of metal lightning. His blood, losing its purpose, ran into me, and I wished we were truly a single body, that I could have held its rush and flow like a second sweaty skin. I can tell you how his spirit slipped out, like steam from cooling water, slowly, fading by degrees, until he stilled.
How did you get the idea of presenting him that way?
Well, I felt with the Trayvon Martin case that it was really so much about symbol. The hoodie became this thing. People were wearing hoodies. There were hoodies with crosshairs as costumes for Halloween by tasteless humans. And so this idea of how we can flatten someone in death, right? That hoodie marked him in that neighborhood as not belonging. And so I thought the poem, symbol is the purview of the poem. And so the poem can take that symbol and give back that boy.
But entering his reality in the poem, the jangle in his pocket, that makes him so real, the jangle of keys and change in his pocket, quiet in his skin, the bullet through us, not through him. The way you occupy his life. That's the best poem on him, and I've read a lot of them.
Thank you.
Lauren Aline, let's have another poem.
Absolutely. So I am from Trinidad and Tobago, as you mentioned, and immigration is such a topic of conversation. I write a lot in my new book, Honeyfish, and this is talking a little bit about the process of getting here. And it's a villanelle, a visa villanelle. First, the gathering of proof, your life's story reduced to a paper jam of required documents, evidence of the right shape of your history. Surrender every expectation of privacy. Release the statements, provide your fingerprints, prove you have nothing to hide, your life's story unremarkable in its mundane trajectory of dream, desire, struggle, overcoming, testament to the harmless shape of your history. Leave home at midnight. Drive through the wee hours to arrive at the embassy door first with your gathered proof, your rehearsed story. Stand in the chilled, street-lit dark. Pray the rosary. Repeat again and again to still your heavy beating heart. You have the evidence, all the right forms. This is but a footnote in your history. Dawn. Sunlight opens the day like a key. Wipe the weary from your eyes. Enter. State your intent. Offer the proof of your life. Tell its story. Provide evidence. Give it the shape that will become your history.
She is Lauren Aline. I am Grace Cavalieri, and I am struck once again, as often as I hear poetry and as often as I read it every day, I am struck more than ever today about how it is more meaningful than op-eds, how that says more about the whole immigration process than all the editorials in the world, because you personify it. Talk about personifying. Talk about what the poet does.
I think one of our opportunities as poets is to enter lyric space, which is to say the internal landscapes of ourselves. And if we do that well enough and clearly enough, it provides a bridge or a pathway for the listener or the reader to come into that space. And so that's my story. But I hope that I tell it in a way that the reader comes with me through that anxiety, through that hopefulness, through that, you know, everything, excitement, thrill, terror, all of it. And I think that's what we get to do with language. I was just teaching intro to advanced poetry this week and telling my students that, you know, we have our brains are wired for empathy. And language is one of the ways we get to access that, right? When we make images concrete in our poems, we trigger the brain so that they are doing those things, they're feeling those things, and that's the way we get to give our experience or our understandings or our insights to someone else.
That had never heard a better description. Lauren Aline, More Poetry at the Library of Congress.
Thank you. This poem is also in Honeyfish, and it's called Trojan Sun. I am from Trinidad. I lived in Iowa twice, and last time for 6 years. I don't do well with the cold weather, but also a rising heat situation as a planet definitely causes some conflict in me. So this is Trojan Sun. It's fall on a winter day, and my island heart beams like a sunflower awash in welcome light. But the dizzied roses of my small garden, caught between wither and bloom, remind me November thunder and short skirt winters means our planet is off kilter, that a mild day in Iowa shows up oceans away as epic, unnatural disaster. Entire villages raised to splinters by wind and water, the shifts in weather around our globe, sometimes slow as evolution, sometimes more big bang for our brazen disregard than we'd bargained for. Already, it's too late for so much. The ozone layer, disappeared rainforests and ecosystems, our dying oceans, the thousand species gone extinct on our watch. But here, it's a November morning, and from a clear sky, the sun halos the bare trees with light bright as fool's gold. Tomorrow, winter returns, dark and dank in tow. For now, the beauty of it all fills my heart to breaking as I head out into our numbered days.
Already it's too late for so much, but yet what there is you capture. And she has won many awards. I'd like you to know that one of the honors for her work was a Philip Frund Alumni Prize for Excellence in Publishing from Cornell. Then she got the Split This Rock Poetry Prize and a Picador Guest Fellowship, no, Professorship in Literature, University of Leipzig, Germany. Now she's Assistant Director of the Furious Flower Poetry Center. And that's what I want to talk about for a minute.
Absolutely.
Because it's world known. You've made an indentation on the universe with this. First of all, the title and what you do.
Absolutely. So the Furious Flower Poetry Center is the nation's first center dedicated to African-American poetry, first academic center. So it is located at James Madison University. Dr. Joanne Gabin is the founder, and it began as a conference in 1994 to honor Gwendolyn Brooks. And that is where the title comes from her poem, Second Sermon on the Warp Land. And the line is, the time cracks into furious flower, lifts its face all unashamed and sways in wicked grace. And so those are the lines that captivated Joanne's imagination and from which the title of the center, Fierce Flower, comes. Yes.
And what do you do?
As the assistant director, I assist Dr. Gabin, but we do, the center holds a conference every 10 years that sort of convenes Black poets and discussing and reading the state of Black poetry. We also, throughout the 10 years in between conferences, we do a reading series at James Madison. We do an educator summit called the Summer Seminars for teachers to help them think about integrating Black poetry into their curricula. We do undergraduate seminar workshops for undergraduate students to work with Black poets in a workshop setting. We do a children's poetry camp that we now call Creativity Camp because they dance and draw and, you know, do yoga, all the arts, you know, sort of supplementing the arts that they do or don't get in schools. We do so much.
Lauren, Eileen, the purposeful life. I mean it. If you didn't do it, it wouldn't get done. So this is the only one of its sort with all with Cave Canem and so many.
It was for a while.
But it was the first.
Yes, it was the first. But there's the Cave Canem is amazing. Mm-hmm. I am a Cave Canem fellow and graduate. That workshop for Black poets, such an amazing space. There's the Center for African American Poetry and Poetics at the University of Pittsburgh, started by Terrence Hayes and Don Lundy Martin, that is doing amazing work. So it's just wonderful to see this blooming, this blossoming of Black poetry and the recognition of the contribution to American letters that Black poets have always been making and continue to make.
And all you had to do was find a way to lift those up to be seen.
Absolutely.
And guess what happened? They are not only seen, but winning all the awards because finally they're being read, these poems. And so you must feel very good about that distribution.
And we're very, very happy to serve.
It's a good way to live, right?
Absolutely.
And yours is a good way to live with poems. We want more.
I would like to read this. My mom is listening in. And this is, I say immigration is so, it's such an interesting journey. And when you're young, as I was, I left home when I was 18, had just turned 18. And now as an adult, I realize how terrifying that must have been for my parents to send your child off to a place you've never been. And so this is an ode to my parents. Root and reach, you are the unlike likenesses haunting my mirror, possessing my throat, shout and song. You are stalwart twin pillars holding me up. A girl made of so much air, you lose sight of her as she sighs her way into spaces you dreamed or never thought to. You who mattered me into being. You who scored ocean into my spirit, placed all my possibility into the hands of a God you cannot see, but still believe worthy of faith. How you hold me still, your disappeared daughter, your prodigal progeny, whose return you celebrate again and again, whose absence you read as testimony, not abandonment. Beloved earth, from whom emerged this reckoning of a woman, the unfed beast of her hunger, mm-hmm. You who pushed and planted and pruned, you who promised more than you can afford and delivered, you of the open hands and doors and hearts, you who let me take my new name, go. You who renamed yourselves always. You who remain.
Tell me about the unfed beast of your hunger. What was that?
Well, you know, I am from a very small village on a very small island where I went to church and school, and there was really no understanding of what was out there, but I just always wanted it, whatever it was.
Oh.
I think I read too many adventure stories as a child, you know, the Nancy Drews.
Was it
and
your
the
idea to emigrate?
My mother just let me do what I was doing. You know, I wrote by hand to 125 universities in America, and she would just take those letters in the morning and mail them. She's like, I don't know what's happening, but I'm just going to do this.
And what 100 of them replied?
Well, we got a lot of brochures in the mail, and it became sort of a neighborhood event. You know, the post lady would come saying, there's more. you know, I got scholarships to about 6 universities. We didn't know a West Virginia from New York City, you know.
Which did you choose?
I did go to St. Francis College in Brooklyn Heights, New York, because I had an aunt who lived in New York, and because the recruiter who came to Trinidad said he would take care of me. So my mom's like, that one.
What a great story. Have you written your memoir?
I have not.
That's next.
All right.
Lauren,
Aline. I'll take the challenge.
Lauren, Aline, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. I couldn't be happier because we're going to hear more. This is from Honeyfish, I should say. And this is an award-winning book. And was it the Green Rose Award?
The Green Rose Prize from New Issues Press, yes.
Yes.
It was a wonderful surprise.
And who issued that? Was it the press that published the book?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And of all the books they published, they gave this the prize.
Yes.
That's what we want to know.
Thank you. Variations in Blue. And this emerges actually from a conversation with Frank X. Walker, which is the epigraph to the poem. So he said to me, I don't know how to swim. And I said, what? And then he said, there were no pools for black folk when I was coming up. And so it just made me realize historical difference in places matters in our experience. In Sleep's 3D theater home, a green island surrounded by the blue of ocean, zoom to the heart, see the Kuva swimming pool filled with us, black children shrieking our joy in a haze of sun, our lifeguard Rodney, his skin flawless and gleaming black as fresh oil, his strut along the pool's edge, his swoon-worthy smile. Daddy, a beach ball-bellied Poseidon, droplets diamonding his afro. My brother hollering as he jumps into his bright blue fear, his return to air gasping and triumphant. And there, the girl I was, dumpling thick and sun brown, stripped down to the red two-piece suit my mother had made by hand, afloat in the blue bed of water, the blue sky gleaming above. When I wake up, I'm in America, where Dorothy Dandridge once emptied a pool with her pinky, and in Texas, a black girl's body draped in its hopeful tasseled bikini struck earth instead of water, a policeman's blue-clad knees pinning her back, her indigo wail a siren. I want this to be a dream, but I am awake, and in this place where the only blue name home is a song, and we are meant to sink, to sputter, to drown.
When you return to your village, what do you love?
I love so much. I mean, it's just it's such a different space. And it's changing, right? The things that I love aren't really there anymore.
Is it getting too metropolis?
It's building up. I was home in November and there was like a gas station at the corner. I'm like, what is this? You know, with its bright 24-hour lights. I mean, we were a dark cane village that didn't have light at night. But, you know, I still love that everybody knows me. I mean, it's just, you know, we live next door to a school and hearing the children sing in the morning, the anthem, and it's a Hindu school, so they also do their prayers in Hindi, so we don't understand what's being said, but, you know, it's been my alarm clock for 18 years, you know, in so many ways. Just the air, the food. Oh, I love the food. The ocean. I got to go to the sea when I go home. And now my niece.
Wow. I'm there. One thing about your poetry is the way it moves. Can you give any hint to people who have staccato lines, who have good lines, and they gather them together, but they don't know how to get from one line to the other? Do you have any hints about that? You're very good at, I know you teach revision.
I do. I think I love lines, and I'm very
you love lines.
I do. I really do.
Every poet loves lines.
No, it's sort of the defining characteristic, isn't it? And I think for me, I'm always trying to figure out what's in the sentence, right? Because the line break and the sentence, that's what I tell my students, there's that amazing tension between the sense of a line and the meaning in a sentence. And so to me, trying to figure out how many things reside within that sentence and where is the moment that if I just give the reader a pause, they can get one of those senses that isn't necessarily, or that is built into the meaning of the sentence. If that makes sense, right? So you can drape one sentence over three or four lines. And by doing that, you sort of phase out the pieces and let us know what all else is in that sentence. What's holding it up?
The secret word is drape. I got it. The secret word is drape. Give us another poem and then a final poem.
Okay, so I will read the title poem of the collection, and this is Honeyfish. A lot of this book was written in or about Greece, where I spent some time, and this poem is kind of from that time. Honeyfish. The catch is so fresh, each bite is blue, the sea still in it and settling on your tongue like prayer. This is what it means to eat, you think, to abandon utensils for the grace of fingers, to hold flesh against flesh, hands slick with what will become inseparable from your own thrumming body. As a child, you loved fried rye, the small fish you ate whole, and imagined them swimming in you, your belly full as an ocean. Now you know better, that nothing consumed lives on as before. When the bone, thin as a wish, lodges itself in the pink flesh of your mouth, refuses offerings of bread or water, becomes an ache that will not be moved, you understand. This is what it means to be a body, that what is taken in takes root in ways beyond your choosing. A single bite, and you carry the ocean in your throat.
And a final poem.
I'm going to go back to Difficult Fruit for the closing. And in Difficult Fruit, I write a lot of poems addressed to myself. And this one is sent to my 15-year-old self. And we can tell it's a little dated because of the first line, but I'll just go for it. 15. I'm writing from 29 to tell you we live. I remember our dreams, the long white halls with no end, and how when we tried to imagine life after high school, it was blank and solid as a grave. We thought that meant there was no future for us and practiced accepting our absence from our own lives. No more best friendships, school dances, no more yearning for boys to whom we are already invisible. Now we are almost twice your age. The face we couldn't envisage is yours, but leaner, with shadows of mom in its profile. In 2 years, we will step on our first plane and fall in love with flight. We will move like wind across the world. We conjugate French class verbs in Paris and Nice. We follow Jesus to Bethlehem and Galilee. We lived in places you do not yet know exist. I see now that it will all begin with you. The path away from home marked with nothing. Who could walk it but the girl who has already made peace with her own end? 15. Looking back, I understand our quiet death wait, the surprise of our persistent daily waking. We never could have imagined this.
The voice of Lauren Alleyne. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.